Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and it's broadcast on Bristol Community FM at noon every Tuesday on bcfmradio.com and 93.2 FM. This week, Mike Sparks, part two of an interview with him as he looks through everything in American CIA conspiracy politics, from a coup attempt in America in 1934 by Prescott Bush, George W. Bush's grandfather, right the way through till the creation, he believes, of ISIS by the CIA in 2014. That's the second part of a two-part interview with Mike Sparks from jamesbondisforreal.com. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio, one word, .co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897, or on the web at prsc.org.uk. And I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. So we start with, and go straight to, the second part of that interview with Mike Sparks from jamesbondisforreal.com.
You know, the military-industrial complex is also guilty of wanting to keep itself going by making, you know, the Russians during the Soviet Cold War era into boogeymen to basically tell the American taxpayer, if you don't give us a big budget, those boogeymen Russians are going to attack us and, you know, incinerate hometown America. And if that doesn't scare the American people enough, you see with 9/11, the Milenkomp actually creating a terrorist act to scare the American people. So it's no longer just a threat. It's like you're running a shop and the two thugs walk into your shop and say, you know, we need our collection, you know, this week for protection. Are you going to pay it? If not, your house and your shop is going to burn down mysteriously this week. I mean, that's what it looks like. It looks like a protection racket.
It looks also, I mean, you've got a similar thing in the 2008 financial crisis with the collapse of Lehman Brothers and essentially financial industry that has done a couple of things. One is speculate wildly on the international markets to try and make money, lost a lot of money, then also been involved in filing fraudulent accounts. So the auditing of the banks, like Royal Bank of Scotland, the NatWest, etc., quite clearly now have been proven to be complete fiction, these audited accounts. The auditors, of course, have walked away with a nice big fat fee rather than with a jail sentence. And that debt has been now picked up by the public. So this, in a way, may be, Mike, described as the greatest heist in history, 2008.
Right, and I have a book on that, too. I call it Racket Theory. You go to combatreform.org, capital letters, Racket Theory, v6.0.htm. And the conclusion that I came to is that human beings want to keep problems in play rather than solve them decisively, because there's more money keeping a problem in play. So basically, the banksters have said, and there are three levels above the nation state figurehead, president, prime minister, whatever. You got the banksters, intel agencies, and the secret societies. You know, whatever they call themselves, you know, Illuminati, you know, the elite, whatever they want to call themselves. So you got three levels above the figurehead nation states. And they say that we're providing the social fabric. They're saying, you know, we're too big to fail, because if you fail us, you'll have no social fabric. You'll have no banking. You'll have no industry. Your sheeple need banks. You need to go to the Bank of America. They need to go to the bank of something. So they got us by the by saying we're providing the social fabric. They're doing the Ayn Rand Atlas Shrugged thing. They're saying you need us whether you like us or not, because we're providing the social fabric. So what I'm saying to unravel this Gordian knot, you got to chop it by saying, no, we're going to create our own social fabric operated by decent people, and we're going to slowly wean you out. Of course, the Illuminati, you know, the elites are not going to like that. But you've got to act decisively. You just don't say, I'm going to disband the CIA in 1,000 pieces. No, you sign the legislation or the executive order. You do it immediately. You don't give these guys a chance to come back and to kill you. That was the mistake of FDR and President Kennedy, is that they didn't act decisively enough to eradicate this right-wing, you know, elite Illuminati. Now, there's also a left-wing form of the Illuminati, too. I don't want to be presenting this as just one-sided. And if you're going to eliminate these people, you need to go to the U.S. Constitution to make it illegal for anyone to be in any government position and a member of any secret society. Because you think about it, if you take an oath to the U.S. Constitution or even to your queen, you can't be doing that and at the same time be a member of a secret society saying, I've sworn to follow whatever Hiram Abiff says. You know, you can't. You know, man can serve two masters. But what you see happening is these people in the modern era realizing that they can outwardly pretend to be a normal person operating under the normal rules of society of, you know, work hard, be the best person, you'll get, you know, promoted, all these fair play rules of decency. Meanwhile, they're meeting tonight, and we're going to just help our guy. He's going to be the guy that we advance. We don't care if the other guy's more qualified. Yeah, he's running for city office here. We're going to help him. We're going to appoint this guy. You know, doing all this underhanded cheating stuff. And people that are type A personality stoics that are snobby, they're attracted to these secret societies where they can get ahead by cheating. You know, no fair play. And the only way we can condemn it is we've got to outwardly condemn it. Say this is outwardly evil and immoral.
Now,
it's un-American, un-British.
Quite a lot of people are looking on the world stage at the moment, looking at the Chinese empire, if you want to call it that. The Chinese power is a kind of countervailing force to the United States, with the Russians, not the Soviet Union anymore, the Russians sandwiched in the middle, all three, of course, nuclear-armed. There's also people like the Indians and the Pakistanis who are looking at, well, which side are we going to be on? And the Russians have actually been doing made an interesting chess move over the last 7 or 8 years with their RT English language channel. They've published quite a lot of good stuff on there. One of their more recent editors, Natalia Makarova, for the op-ed section, I was just having a chat with her recently about the possibility of doing some article exposing the links between Mark Lane's work and the conspiracy theory term, which was generated by the CIA we were talking about earlier on. And, you know, they seem to have changed quite a lot recently. They're not interested in publishing stuff like that. I got a blank refusal. Well, we're not interested in that, which is quite strange. Maybe they've done deals with the Americans. But I wonder what you make of this, because it seems that we're moving towards a situation, Mike, where there may be some kind of orchestrated confrontation between East and West. And, of course, these are nuclear-armed powers, nuclear-armed states. We know back in the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, there was a definite attempt to start a nuclear war. We were getting quite close to it with people like Curtis Lee May and General Power deliberately advocating for a winnable nuclear exchange with no more than expectable casualties, civilian casualties, talking about something like 6 or 7 million being an expectable casualty exchange, which they believe they could win ultimately. So that's what they were looking at in 1962. It didn't happen, but there are still elements that might look at that a nuclear exchange as a feasible thing to happen. So I wonder, a lot of people now are looking at, for example, particularly what's going on in the Middle East, and coming up with apocalyptic as the word. Well, I hear that again and again. I mean, we're getting it in the Brexit debate at the moment. So we're saying, well, if Britain leaves Europe, it's going to be an apocalyptic scenario. And, I mean, we know biblically we've got a kind of almost like a great big poster put up there in the book of Revelation of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the white horse, the red horse, the grey horse, the pale horse, the idea being to kind of warn humanity, to say to humanity, look, hey guys, when you hear the hooves on the cobblestones outside, you know what's going on. The red horse certainly, I mean, white horse is a little bit difficult to untangle what that means. The red horse certainly is about war. The grey horse is definitely about economic collapse following that war. And then the pale horse, the last one, is about a mass wipeout of populations across the planet due to disease, pestilence, famine, this kind of thing. So this is a scenario which people are starting to look at now, looking ahead and thinking, well, hey, man, maybe we're nearly there.
Well, the thing is that the propellant of this is, you know, secret societies are propelling towards this because you say, why would they want to do anything the Bible says? Well, the thing is that their view is a Satanist view, which is that we're on spaceship Earth, we're a lifeboat. And Thomas Malthus says, you know, fruit flies are going to keep eating the gelatin in their petri dish until they, you know, kill themselves by too much pollution from, you know, themselves. So you've got Malthusian thinkers in the elites who want to see a controlled nuclear exchange, let's say, between India and Pakistan. And I've written about it in a James Bond fiction novel called Masquerade. Everything is not what it appears. And I've got it posted for free, fan fiction, James Bond story. But you can see that they would love to see 2 billion people go away, because right now the planet's got 7 billion. And they feel that the planet is overcrowded. Now, the Christian response should be, well, we need to get off this rock and start colonizing, because mankind is at his best when he's conquering new worlds, not conquering other people and killing them and taking their stuff. Mankind is at his best when he's having to use his ingenuity to overcome the elements. You know, I call it the battle against the Earth here on the planet, but this would be the battle against Mars. You know, let's terraform Mars. Let's get people off this rock. And then people will be acting nobly. They'll be working together. And elbow room is also a factor for freedom. But what's helping propel the elites to get away with this, I call this the mask of command. And one of the guys hurting us in the Bay of Pigs and later on with the Cuban Missile Crisis is in the Cuban camp. It's not Fidel Castro. It's his, you know, terrorist leader with the beard. I forget his name right off the bat. But anyway, he was the guy that got the nuclear weapons placed there in the first place. He told Fidel, we need the nuclear weapons to keep the Americans out.
But yeah, but I mean, at the time, the Americans had nuclear weapons in Turkey, didn't they? So the Russians were basically, that was a counter move to what the NATO had been doing.
Perspective, right? Che Guevara, when he fought courageously as a leader by example, he got this aura of being invincible, just like LeMay. If you look at LeMay's career, I don't see how he survived. He's leading B-17 and B-24 and B-29 bomber streams into thick flak and fighter, you know, contested areas and coming out alive. Everyone else around him is dying. It's like LeMay and Che Guevara both had what I call the mask of command, the mask of invincibility, which drove us nearly to a nuclear war in this Cuban Missile Crisis, because Che got the nuclear weapons, you know, placed in Cuba by convincing Fidel. And he was ready to push the button because they personally feel that they're somehow going to come out survive. Now, don't ask me, but, you know, LeMay would have been an Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska in some deep underground thing. Guess he would have made it. I don't see how Che would have survived a nuclear exchange. But these guys feel that they're invincible. And that's the thing we've got to watch out for here in the military, is that we can't start creating these superhero military guys. Like, all of them had this. MacArthur felt he was invincible. Patton. These guys that are really charismatic, Gavin even, leaders.
I mean, surely that's the part, Mike, that's partly the mindset of someone that's going to win in this kind of warfare, is that they've got to have that almost air of invincibility, and they've got to really believe that they can win in a battle. That actually helps them to win. And this is maybe part of the kind of game theory that we've been dealing with since the Kennedy assassination, where a lot of international affairs, and maybe this has been going on for longer than that, are treated almost like a game.
Oh, definitely. You know, they tried to do the game theory and say, look, there's no winner in this, to try to create mutually assured destruction. You know, with the people at Harvard, I believe, ran the computation and say no rational man's going to believe this. But I tell you, your Che Guevara's and LeMay's say, look, man, you're a civilian. You haven't been where I've been. You know, when the flak is this thick and, you know, Che Guevara and the bullets are whizzing by my head and I prevailed. And they forget that the common man isn't a Che Guevara. He isn't a Curtis LeMay. And he's going to die when that nuclear blast goes off. He's going to die. He's not going to survive somehow. But what you have this heroism. We all like to believe in heroes, but we're believing in the wrong ones. And we need to believe in heroes like John F. Kennedy, who said, yes, I survived the PT-109 thing, but a few of my guys didn't. And I can't assume that everyone's going to be a John Kennedy if a disaster happens to a nation.
Can you, tell us about the PT-109?
Well, the PT-109 situation was, if I remember this correctly, the radar wasn't working, and so it's in the middle of the dark night, and they're in a fog, and a Japanese destroyer just cuts right through them, you know, by surprise, and causes a fire because the PT boat's powered by gasoline and it's plywood. And Kennedy, in a heroic form, was able to round the men up together with some floating materials, and then, you know, kick to the shore nearest sandbar, and kept the men together for several days, even one guy with burns, and was able to find some natives that had some connection to the Coast Watchers.
Okay, so this is in the Pacific War.
Pacific War, and Kennedy got there because he was having an affair with Inga Arvad. Look, I'd have an affair with her too. She was a hot chick, but she was a journalist who also was kind of cozy with Hitler. So J. Edna Hoover did not like Kennedy, and has recordings, again, with the phonographic records, right, of Inga and Kennedy doing their thing, and it ended his military intelligence career. John F. Kennedy Sr., Joe Kennedy Sr., was grooming Kennedy for presidency, of course, his oldest son, who got killed in a bomber full of explosives, which is kind of like a 9/11 thing, incidentally. And, you know, his second son, John Kennedy, wanted him in military intelligence, which is safer job. But because of the affair that he was having, he was lucky to get out without being put in prison and still stay in the Navy. So they transferred him to PT boats, where he got to actually show some true heroism. But Kennedy doesn't come out of PT-109, you know, rescuing his own crew, you know, from that unfortunate circumstance of bad military equipment, if you ask me. But it should have been a diesel-powered boat, less fire risk, should have had radar. You know, you're not going to get me started on that. Okay, hydrofoil maybe even. But the point is that he didn't come away like Che Guevara and LeMay thinking he's personally invincible. If anything, he had Addison's disease. Kennedy probably shouldn't even have been allowed to run as president. So the thing with Hillary Clinton being so unhealthy, being allowed to run for president, I think if Hillary becomes president for some god-awful reason, you know, the way that she's cheating and the Illuminati are helping her, I predict she won't make it to the first term. She's just not healthy enough. You saw what it does. The presidency ages people terribly.
I mean, I've seen that. I mean, it might just be anecdotal, but I mean, I've seen that with our mayor here in Bristol, George Ferguson. He's just done a 4-year term as mayor. It looks like it's taken about 15 years off the poor chap, you know, in power. And I guess this is partly to do with the responsibility and whether you've got a good team around you, whether there's a lot of heartache and mistrust and this kind of thing. But look, let's get back to the sort of Armageddon scenario. And I'm not foisting that on you, but I'd just like to know how you think we as humanity can kind of rid ourselves of the oppressive, I suppose this is the military-industrial complex. At the end of the day, these are the people who are, through trying to grab public funds, taxpayers' money, our time and effort, are trying to dominate the planet. How we can sort of overturn that rule, you know, which is done through democracy and through the press, through propaganda.
Right, but you've got to understand their racketeering could blow up in their face. They're trying to racketeer a mild threat that over years means, okay, the Chinese are doing this. We need better patrol planes. We need better patrol craft that can get closer to the shore. They want to racketeer this if they're doing racket theory well, without having the host organism die on you, which would be what a nuclear exchange would be. But you've got another problem here. You got David Rockefeller's 100 years old. You got Henry Kissinger looks like crap. I mean, these guys might have nothing to lose, and on their deathbed, they just say, start it. Start World War III, because I'm out of here. Okay? That's another factor. So you've got people wearing the mask of command, thinking that they're invincible in the military. You got people wearing the mask of, you know, power, like David Rockefeller and company, and the Rothschilds, who think that they have, you know, Lucifer, Satan actually talking to them. They actually feel that they have supreme supernatural power. You've got these people stumbling towards a World War III by either racketeering, milking, or actually pulling the plug and starting it. What we need to do is draw back. And what was said in the movie and in the play, Camelot, is profound because, you know, King Arthur said there will always be wars as long as people are fighting over boundaries and fences. So what you have in the Far East are people with too many people living and growing in China and Japan, South Korea, and all these countries in the high humidity. Their populations are growing out of control. They need fisheries. They need to be able to fish these areas, and you've got them fighting over who has control over this fishing area. And it's going to increase. So what we have to do is not let these boundaries clash, which could cause a war, right? So that's the source of it. So these people are taking artificial reefs and turning them into islands to then use that as a claim for, you know, a larger watery area for fishing. So what we have to do is stop this encroachment and fence building, so to speak, that's going to clash, right? So what I would say is have a council of all the nations, you know, endangered, you know, by this, and just go ahead and divvy the water up. Instead of just slow encroachment and then just you fight for me and I put 15 guys on this piece of rock and say it's an island, you know, stop this out of control thing. Let's just say, here's the map. Let's get an agreement. This is what you got. And then let's move on, because that's all you're going to get here. Let's get off this rock. Let's start working on, you know, terraforming Mars and getting some people off this planet. Or talking to Australia and you know, working with them to get some of their land in a nice way, not like taking over Australia, okay? The Chinese will probably find somebody in the 12th dynasty landed a landing party in Australia, and Australia is really a Chinese province. You know, that kind of stuff. They're playing all kinds of these games. Instead of letting this thing unravel, you see what I'm saying, in a disorganized, unruly manner.
I mean, yeah, you're talking about fishing rights, but actually one of the biggest motivations we haven't even mentioned yet is oil, isn't it? And that seems to be a big feature of the modern world is this kind of resource war over oil deposits, particularly in the Middle East. And I wonder to what extent, you know, that is the motivating force behind a lot of the Middle Eastern wars, Syria, Libya, all these things over the, you know, Iraq, obviously, and ISIS. And to what extent there's this religious factor which is trying to drum up a kind of religious war between Israel, the sort of Zionist version of the Jewish project over the centuries and millennia, and Islam.
Well, that's being instigated by the CIA. There's no doubt that we know how to make free energy. So the oil dependence of the United States is a technological dead end that we've chosen to keep milking. Pardon the not a good analogy using milk, but it's oil that we're milking that we don't need to. I mean, you can look at the factors of how much oil is used and consumed in the United States, and we could cut half of it right away with, you know, the infrastructure of homes and businesses and industry getting their oil. I'm sorry, they're getting their power other than oil. Okay, so if you don't want to go with the exotic free energy, but, you know, alternative means, that cuts half of the oil consumption right there. And then there's no need to go to another foreign country and take their oil. Because believe it or not, the United States produces half of its oil needs as it is right now. So, you know what I mean? It's kind of a fractional, statistical, geek kind of thing. You look at it, and if you had an honest president of the United States and administration, you'd solve that.
So you're saying that maybe that these Middle Eastern wars really, I mean, you seem to be putting together a case that there isn't actually any real motivation for oil there.
No, they make it. They make it by not having 50% of our, you know, energy needs taken care of by alternative. They're deliberately keeping us dependent, you know, that we have to import at least 50% of our oil. You see, the Illuminati, the elites, deliberately racketeer that, and then that gives them a foreign policy excuse to go overseas and expand American hegemony.
So that's almost like a kind of Trojan – oil is a kind of Trojan horse as an excuse to get into the Middle East. Fascinating.
And then the consumers buy into it. You know, you talk about the cliche ending argument, right? You know, not just conspiracy theory. We need that oil. That's a code word to the American sheeple. Hey, I like all of these consumer products that I got. I like my dollar or $2, you know, gallon gas. I don't like this Dick Cheney guy. He's an evil guy, but he's our evil guy. He's working for us to keep our consumerist lifestyle together, and I'll look the other way. So the American people are not innocent in this. The American people are complicit, and they're not innocent. They're guilty for letting all this evil stuff be done in the name of the United States of America. If we had a president of the United States like a Henry Wallace, he'd be all over the numbers as a techno geek, but we love him. And he would say, look, we're going to be a moral country. We're going to choose these different set of numbers. It'll be a harder set for us. You know, won't be as easy, but, you know, the rich won't be getting rich. But we'll be a moral country that people will still look up to.
A part of all of this, of course, is, I mean, this is going right back to the Nazis, Mike, is they were the first to have their autobahns in the 1930s. The Americans pretty much picked up pretty quickly afterwards with freeways. And then us here in Britain in the 1960s were building motorways. This obsession with the car is a kind of almost like a personal buy-in. Everybody that's got a car has bought in to these Middle Eastern wars. And I wonder whether you think maybe we should be organising our transportation, you know, maybe people actually going less of a distance to work backwards and forwards every day, or maybe even using some kind of rail transport.
You nailed it. You nailed it. You've nailed the 1945 endgame big time. 1945, the right-wing Republican Nazi party took over the United States, and shortly thereafter trains were de-emphasized. With the Eisenhower administration, they said, nah, trains are too efficient. We're going to have everybody driving an inefficient Rockefeller oil-powered car. So he created the national interstate highway system, claiming national security reasons, of course, which is bogus. If I want to move tanks, I put them on flat cars on a railway and get them to Fort Bragg. I don't move them inefficiently by a truck transporter where Joe Blow, you know, the truck driver has a tank hijacked from him while he was eating, you know, at the restaurant. I mean, it's unsafe, unsecure, inefficient to move things by cars and trucks, and unsafe. 50,000 people die each year. Of course, you know, the elites, they want that. They think we're overpopulated. But you nailed it. We need to be better organized, which would be using high-speed trains to get across the country. The United States is 2,600 miles across, you know, 2,000 miles deep. It's ludicrous. Why do these other countries, Europeans and the Japanese, have bullet trains and we don't? Our bullet train, the Amtrak train, 40 miles an hour, you can almost run faster than the Amtrak can go. So they don't want us to work together. You see, if I had a high-speed train system the way we should be done, I should be able to hop on a high-speed train, and I could be in England in a day. I should be able to just meet with you and do this radio show. We should have a giant bridge or tunnel connecting the United States and England by high-speed train if we were really on the ball, which the Illuminati don't want us on the ball, sharing ideas and dreams and all that stuff. They want us to stay in our 50-mile radius, miserable consumers, watching TV, watching brainwashed hypnotic messages fed us, and depressed. But the fact of the matter is, there was a conscious change away from trains during the Eisenhower administration towards, you know, personally owned vehicles, POVs, which is unsafe, unsound, keeps us depressed, keeps us oppressed, and keeps the Rockefellers rich.
You know, one of the other things is if you're sitting on a train, you could even maybe think about reading a book. You certainly can't do that when you're sitting behind the wheel of a car.
You better not. Some people probably do. But, you know, you've got the scene from Casino Royale. Beautiful scene where, you know, Daniel Craig is sitting in a high-speed train and beautiful Eva Green walks in. And that's a wonderful scene in the movie. And they fall in love immediately because when she realizes he's an orphan. I love that scene. And that all happened because they're living like decent people, moving like decent people do on a train, which Ian Fleming loved. He loved trains because he says that's the decent way people move in a civilized manner. You can have a meal. He said that after the meal was over with, remember, he says, I felt skewered because, you know, Eva Green's character tore him apart psychologically. He was an orphan. It's a beautiful scene, beautiful movie, and it's got a message. It's saying, why aren't we moving like James Bond and, you know, Vesper Lynn, a high-speed train?
Now, we had an interview with British writer and journalist Chris Hewitt on this show on Dialect, well, I'm thinking maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, because he was speaking down here about the lessons that there are in Britain to learn from the way the Irish rail network was organised. Looking at the British network, it was absolutely dismembered in the 1960s, 1963, 1964, as part of something called the Beeching Plan, the Beeching Acts, which was called the restructuring of British railways. But effectively, it knocked the heart out of the railway network in order to sort of go alongside the car expansion, the motorway expansion, the car industry expansion. And one of the key figures, well, the key figure in that was a guy called Dr. Richard Beeching, formerly of ICI. He'd been working in the Second World War in the Woolwich Arsenal as a deputy head of the design of weapons for the Second World War. Of course, the reason he was involved with ICI Chemical, Imperial Chemical Industries, was because they were the biggest manufacturer of explosives in the Second World War, and that's what that was, what that connection was. But after the war, I mean, he was a metallurgist by profession. A lot of people in the 1960s raised their eyebrows a little, saying, what is a metallurgist doing, taking over the control of all of British railways and deciding on which are the most efficient lines and which are the most efficient lines? Because, I mean, all he could really do maybe to be scrape a little bit of metal off one of the tracks and examine it under a microscope and tell you what its tensile strength was. He wasn't an accountant. He certainly wasn't an expert in kind of procurement for a railway, that kind
or
of
transportation
thing.
Expert. He's not interested in time motion efficiency.
Well, he was involved actually. He was a key person in this thing called the Tube Alloys Project, which was set up by Winston Churchill at the end of the Second World War, and that no one really knows where the money, maybe you can help us here, came from for the British Atomic Bomb Project, because Churchill, when he was voted out of office in 1945, disappeared off the scene, and then he popped back up in around about 1953 saying, hey, I've just built an atomic bomb. And Beeching was one of the main people involved as a metallurgist in that, in Fort Halsted in the North Downs, just south of London, near Sevenoaks in Kent. Westrum,
money
which is
does
also
not grow on trees.
Also, of course, this area, Fort Halsted, is very close also to Churchill's home, actually not far from where I was brought up in around Orpington, Sevenoaks, Bromley area, in southeast London. So you've got a bit of a nexus going on there. There are also reports in Dorking, just a little while away at, along the North Downs, of Martin Bormann living there. Just after the Second World War, people saying that they'd seen him. That's one of the leads. I haven't managed to actually track the people down. They seem to have gone a bit cold on that one. But what with Churchill and Morton living very close by, Beeching being involved too in this, I wonder what you make of that, because you've brought together there quite a lot of threads of secrecy, and it does seem to me that Beeching was employed to destroy virtually British railways and to turn it into a kind of thing that just worked for big business. It certainly doesn't work for the passengers anymore. I mean, the most inflated fares in the whole of Europe.
You know, is that, you know, money doesn't grow on trees. I wish that you had like a sketch artist that when you interview these people, have them draw what they saw, you know, of Martin Bormann, because we could then see if he was, you know, recipient of any plastic surgery. So, you know, if you do interview some of these people, if you can get a sketch artist or even have them identify some pictures and don't, you know, don't have subtitles in the bottom and say, is this what he looks like? Is this what he looked like? You know what I'm talking about? Because in the OPJB book, they had, you know, some coverage by John Ainsworth Davis of the doppelganger Bormann thing going on. I'm just saying, you know, just a little investigative technique. But money doesn't grow on trees, and England was definitely broke at the end of the war. So for England to have any money, surprisingly, for something expensive like a nuclear bomb project, or like you're saying, reorganization of the trains, it looks clearly like it's Nazi money, that they made a deal with Bormann, get him out of there, and he gave them a few of his accounts. I don't believe he gave anywhere near all of the money. Of course not. But he gave them more money they would have got than if they hadn't got him out. So they can rationalize in their mind that they got more money for England than they would have if they had just, you know, killed him. So clearly it's dirty money. It's Nazi money that's funding this.
Operation James Bond, I mean, Fleming himself talks about going under a mountain, doesn't he, in Switzerland?
Right, and the guy kind of turned his head and let him look and say, you didn't see this, but, you know, if you look over there, this is what we got in storage, you know, over here in good old Switzerland. So the things, the clues that I would look for with your metallurgist guy would be secret society membership. I would look around the edges, peripherals, to see who he's confabbing with, to see who he might be just acting as a puppet for these vested interests.
Well, he was appointed by the Conservative Party in 1963 as the chairman of British Railways, which was a nationalised institution. It had been taken over from the individual train companies, which had been there for 100-whatever years or so, had built the biggest rail network in the world. And so, I mean, difficult to know.
Was it
about
effective? I mean, if it isn't broke, why fix it?
Well, exactly. But it was Ernest Marples that was the transport secretary who appointed him. Now, Ernest Marples was also the owner of the majority share in a company called Marples Ridgeway, which was the road building civil engineering firm. And Marples, at the end of his ignominious career as transport secretary, had to actually get on a plane to Monaco because the British tax man was after him. He'd avoided paying a lot of tax, so he actually ended his days as a tax exile, not able to actually come back to Britain, otherwise he'd be arrested. Now, that was the guy that commissioned the motorway program alongside Richard, and also appointed Richard Beeching to run the railway closed down program. Now, just also worth mentioning there that on, for example, freight, up until the 1960s, you could take anything from any one part of Britain to another by freight, including things like chickens and cows, right? Beeching put a total end to that. The only thing after 1963 that could be moved around the country was bulk transport. We're talking about a whole train load. So, for example, coal, aggregates, oil could all be moved by trains. If you had a whole train load, like 30 or 40...
Yeah, but not small business people.
Nobody else could use it. Nobody else could use it. And, of course, that's one of the reasons we've got so many hundreds of thousands of lorries on our roads, which cause all sorts of accidents. But also, more importantly, maybe destroy those roads. So they're actually crushing the tarmac. They're not paying anything like the amount of road tax they should be paying. And effectively, the car drivers, ordinary individual car drivers that don't actually destroy the roads with their the weights of their vehicles are actually subsidizing the commercial transport.
Right. It's definitely a destructive racket. And so what you're seeing is a racket that's malicious, done in bad faith, and they will probably creep up to the edge of where they actually kill the organism. And then they'll say, oh, we need to save the British road network. And then they'll try to ka-ching, you know, using the apocryphal language to ka-ching, to get a better, bigger ka-ching. But then, you know, you'll go right back to the inefficiency that created the crisis in the first place, which is that, you know, as much as possible, trains should move everything. It's not everything.
Now, you mentioned the Bilderbergers. Right. They're obviously very closely, I mean, anyone that looks at them can see they're very closely involved with NATO. And I wonder what you make of that relationship, because these people, Bilderberg, it's royalty, it's banksters, it's oil companies, it's people like Rupert Murdoch's company, the big media, a lot of them are there, the BBC, Go, The Economist. And really, all of the major industrial powers in Europe and the United States go to these in the NATO countries. They also right. seem to kind of select politicians, so, and also secretary generals of NATO as well. What they do is they'll say, have a politician come along, and it was fascinating to see just the other day in a German newspaper, the former German defense minister, Andreas von Bülow, was saying, well, actually, these meetings, although they say that they're about social policy, they're just about war. That's the reality of it. And yeah. that the real role of the Bilderberg conferences is to invite everyone who's powerful along, and then to see if they say anything against this kind of Pentagon military-industrial complex plan for the world. And if they do, they just get identified, almost like a kind of imaginary X on their forehead. And then by one means or another, they will be removed from power. I just wonder what you make of the Bilderbergs.
Well, right. I think that the document that we should all look at is produced in 1954, and it was leaked around 1973. And it's
Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars.
Right. It says that there are economic inputs, there are social inputs, and they've broken down societal behavior into inputs with, you know, a mathematical formula. And in it is very diabolical. It says from the very outset that they know they could create a public utopia. They admit it. They just said, we're not going to do it. We're going to make a private utopia, which means that it'll be some people, us, will be well off by what system we come up with, and the rest of everyone's going to be miserable. But they admit that there could be a public utopia with even using their diabolical, crass, you know, inputs, you know, the economic inputs and the sociological inputs and all that. They could all be good faith inputs if they wanted to. And they're not, as you can see. What they're using is war as the, you know, chief organizing activity for societies. And the war that's underway right now is, I call it whack-a-mole, you know, Islamic nihilist whack-a-mole. Basically, the CIA has put together what they call the hornet's nest philosophy strategy. You attract men with no life, no life to look forward to, nihilism, right? And they're claiming notionally to be Islamists, to the Middle East, where they get to be rock stars. They get to run around with an AK-47 AKM and wear a headdress and some cool T-shirts and go around beheading people and all that kind of stuff. And they get to be the center of attention. And since they have nothing to live for, they're nihilists, they're all congregated together so we can play whack-a-mole with them, which is using a fighter bomber, very expensive, 10,000 feet, 500-plus miles an hour, drops a precision-guided munition, could be up to $1 million each. And you whack the mole. Whack, head pops up. Whack, head pops up here. And that's what they're playing. Last year, the Pentagon here in the United States made $4 billion playing Islamic whack-a-mole just, you know, in the Syria and western Iraq. It's military incompetence, deliberate. It's military malpractice. They're deliberately milking a problem. The way you solve the problem would be obviously disband the CIA that created ISIS in the first place. It's, ISIS is a chick with nice tits and cleavage. Come on, she's an Egyptian fertility goddess. So that's a boo-boo on the part of people at Langley putting a little inside joke in there. ISIS. Yeah, right. It's Islamic. Yeah, ISIS. Mm-hmm. I want to date ISIS. Come on. What are you doing tonight? Come on. So basically, you have a situation where, you know, they're coming and going freely through the Syrian-Iraqi border. Well, what do? You build a wall. You build a sensor security fence. You close the place up. That's the first step after you disband the CIA. And you have quick reaction forces backing it, just like the Maurice Line did, you know, for France. France had 2 years to get a political settlement in Algeria. The military did its job, which is seal the border, stop the FMNLN guerrillas from crossing and getting weapons. There was a pause where they could have had a political settlement. And that's what you do in western Iraq and Syria. You build a wall connected to the Saudi Arabian wall that they're building. Then nobody's going into western Iraq. Then you go clear the cities out of these nihilist guys that have nothing to live for. But the political settlement in Iraq would be to a confederation. You've got to give, you know, the Kurds a chunk of land, and you got to give the Sunnis a chunk, and the Shias a chunk. This bit about trying to create a, you know, united federalist one government, you know, Iraq isn't going to work. And it never was intended to work, as it intended to keep civil war going. But I did suggest this to Senator Biden, giving you a little personal history, and he liked it. Biden claims it's his idea, but he got it from me. I contacted his office and said, you know, the solution here is a confederacy. And to his credit, Biden tried to run it up the flagpole. But, you know, the elites don't want peace in Iraq. They want civil war in Iraq. But I'm just saying that that would be the solution. The solution would be to wall off, you know, western Iraq from Syria. And then you clean out these guys trying to be rock stars. And then you have to have a political settlement.
So I mean, it looks like what we're looking at is a whole series, really, of these lose scenarios. So, you know, people are going into, including the British, the Americans, the French, NATO generally, going into wars, which are going to generate fantastic amounts of revenue for the military-industrial complex. The idea of almost like this Orwellian idea of a never-ending war. But and yet the Russians do seem, for example, in South Ossetia and Syria, to have a much more limited approach. So they'll go in for a short period of time to do a job and then get out.
Yeah, but they back it by maneuver. You see the difference? You've got to remember, once the Russians came in there to do their limited bombing campaign, it was to prop up the Syrian army so that they would do some maneuvers to take back some key cities, to gain back some territorial control. We're not using any maneuver. Building a wall is actually combat engineering, the act of it, but it's actually maneuver. It's actually taking away the land that the ISIS is exploiting, the chaotic western Iraq and eastern Syria, taking that land away from them for the frolic and to maneuver, to do their little PR stunts.
No, anyway, so let me drag you back to the Bilderbergs. What do you make of them? Because there's definitely a clear connection with NATO. They started in 1954, chaired by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, former
right. I would have
SS
people
officer.
Read that book. You know, the document's been released. It's the manual, you know, the Quiet Weapons, Secret Wars thing. Read that in detail.
Let's just get that absolutely nailed. Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars.
Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, right. And you can get the PDF file. Read that, and there's some really nasty stuff in there about how they manipulate the military person to where if you don't join the military, you're a wimp. The women folk aren't going to look up to you, and they're not going to, you know, show any cleavage. They're not going to marry you and have any children. So what they've done is just magnified that now with the all-volunteer force. When the book was written, you know, 1954, the draft was still in effect. So the manual's still a little bit dated, but they've just transferred it to a volunteer thing. And if you don't volunteer for the armed forces, then you're a wimp and everything like that. But I've actually briefed a Bilderberg member, the vice chief of staff of the U.S. Army, General John Keane, to try to get him to do something good for the U.S. Army, which I thought he had still some loyalty towards, which was to get an armored vehicle that fits inside a CH-47 helicopter so we can get off roads and stop having me and my men get blown up by landmines. A vehicle called the BV-206S still could be used in the same way I'm talking about. Still needs to be done. It's a good idea. He agreed to everything I said and then didn't do a damn thing. I find out later he's a Bilderberg member. Him going overseas and representing the United States is breaking the law, the Logan Act, doing that. He has no right to go to Bilderberg meetings as a retired general, active duty general, whatever. He has no right to go there.
But the main man there is Henry Kissinger, no doubt about it. He's like the spider in the middle there. Everyone's coming up to Henry, offering to buy him a drink, having a little chit-chat. What's his role been in this scenario we've been talking about earlier, right the way from the attempted coup in the United States back in 1934 through Alan Dulles and Lyndon Johnson getting involved with the assassination of John F. Kennedy, right the way through the 9/11 attacks, which it looks like were certainly partly organized through the Central Intelligence Agency to create an excuse for this war on terror nonsense to generate money for the military-industrial complex. How's Kissinger been involved in all of this?
A very good question. He's one of those guys that, you know, you collect information over the years. But here's Kissinger in 1945 as an NCO, non-commissioned officer, staff sergeant, in Germany, Nazi Germany, supposedly in military intelligence, supposedly debriefing Nazis. So that's your base for Henry Kissinger. You have to start off with that base. Most people start off with him in the 1950s as a Harvard wonk professor talking about other options than just mutually assured destruction, you know, talking about flexible response, which, you know, General Gavin likes. So Gavin has nice words to say about Henry Kissinger, the Harvard professor. But, you know, Gavin had him under his command. He just didn't even know about it. You know what I'm saying? Could have had him under command. You know, Gavin was an airborne, you know, obviously there was a land-based army, bigger part that, you know, Kissinger was working for. You know, his early, you know, origins in this don't look good. It looks like he was helping Nazis escape, Nazi war criminals become part of the American military industrial complex. Okay, that's not a good start. So he's pro-Nazi, helping them get over here with, you know, Operation Sunrise, later becomes Paperclip with, you know, Alan Dulles. You know, someone should write a book about early Kissinger, and you just have to just, you know, be a chick probably, would probably help. And you interview good old Henry and the Kissinger, and you just come over there and say, Henry, we want to do a bio of your early career. And just do it, you know, without revealing that you're trying to find out how evil he is. You know, do it while he's still alive. But there's just a mystery period. Well, how does a staff sergeant in the U.S. Army become a Harvard professor? Is the first question that comes to my mind. Okay. I mean, obviously, a smart guy, that time period, people did seem to get rewarded somewhat for being brilliant and hardworking. Well, somehow he's a Harvard professor. So we go to the next Henry Kissinger. And that Kissinger, you know, ingratiates himself with the, you know, flexible response people, with, you know, the new incoming Kennedy administration and Gavin, and becomes a fixture with the presidencies, no matter who they are. You know, LBJ, Nixon, because he's got the ideas. He's, you know, flexible response means more, something more than just let's just nuke them. And do you know, according to Oliver Stone's Secret History of the United States, which is a good series to watch, for one thing, he agrees with me on this Henry Wallace thing. He's the first person that's kind of caught up on that. I wrote about it in 2011 in the, you know, my book, James Bond is Real, about the Henry Wallace thing. He's picked up on it, you know, and I'm glad to see that he picked up on it. But he also said, and it's got to listen carefully, he said that we've threatened to nuke North Vietnam 17 times, and they didn't budge. So Oliver Stone is saying, you know, okay, fine. You can, let's say you continued with the Eisenhower presidency indefinitely. At some point, some people are going to say, go ahead and nuke us. We're not going to budge. And so that's one of the fears that people have, even during the 50s. What else if we nuke the Vietnamese, let's say, surrounding Dien Bien Phu in 54? We nuke them, and it doesn't work. I mean, it doesn't cause them to cry uncle, and it doesn't even on the ground wipe out enough of them. You see what I mean? The fear factor connected to nuclear weapons would go away. So anyway, Henry Kissinger's coming along saying, negotiate, let's make a deal here. We'll pull out our troops if you guys don't start putting new troops in past the DMZ. You know, he's doing all these things so we could pull out of Vietnam peace with honor. But he doesn't tell you that we leave the North Vietnamese divisions that were already in the South in place. We don't insist on the North Vietnamese leaving. So they're ready to do an instant invasion, you know, once the American presence is gone. And the American presence, well, we don't need them. If they were really studly, those Arvin South Vietnamese troops would fight hard. We gave them a style of warfare the Vietnamese could not continue. The turbine engine helicopter, you need to be a technician. You need to be a guy that knows what he's doing, and you've got to change those transmissions out on those helicopters, or they'll seize up and they'll crash and blow up. You know, the helicopter is not simple to maintain. Yet here we're giving the Arvin this style of warfare, American style of warfare, that cannot be continued by them, which is based around a fire base, which means you have artillery pieces in the fire bases that can reach to 11 kilometers, and you fly troops in helicopters and drop them off on foot only within artillery range. Well, what the North Vietnamese did was they got the superior ranging Soviet M46 130mm artillery piece, which has a range of 35 kilometers plus, and they started bombing the fire bases, well, actually shelling the fire bases, and there's nothing we can do about it. I mean, the Arvin couldn't do anything about it. We couldn't do anything about it. And they busted the fire bases. So once the fire bases were exploded, the Arvin fled, causing a panic, and before long, South Vietnam falls. So that's what Kissinger did for South Vietnam.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans in the past. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guest, Mike Sparks, took us through a whole litany of CIA misdemeanors. right the way from the coup in the United States attempt in 1934 up to the creation of ISIS in 2014 by the CIA, he believes. And thanks also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. You can find Mike's work at James Bond is for real, F-O-R-R-E-A-L, jamesbondisforreal.com. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute through the People's Republic at Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until, hopefully, the same time next week. Bye for now.
Down. You can come by. And Well, they certainly don't hedge their bets. I urge you to try and track down their recordings, if you've not already done so, and give them a serious listen. That's Consolidated, the last from them tonight, obviously. America Number One is the title of it.